Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. Today we sit down with Ben Baker, one of the world's most sought-after portrait photographers. He's photographed the last five US presidents and their families, as well as countless celebrities including Oprah, Kanye West, Bono, Jay-Z, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Leo DiCaprio, and so many more. Growing up in Adelaide, Ben couldn't have dreamed of being in such a position. However, having spent a lot of time following his dad through the outback, he did know that an office job wasn't for him. He lobbed into New York without much photography experience, but plenty of Aussie attitude, which won over legendary photographer Annie Leibovitz. Ben talks about what he learned from Annie and other big-name photographers, his mentors, who were among the most influential people in the celebrity scene. Ben says that ultimately it's all about people and building rapport, much more than any technical prowess with a camera. He also shares what he's learned about the world's most powerful people, getting the job done under the highest levels of pressure, including a six-minute shoot with Obama, and of course the key elements of an amazing portrait, and much more. Enjoy Ben Baker's fascinating story and insights.
Ben Baker, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
The portrait, the face. When you first look at a face that you're going to have to shoot, where does your eye gravitate? What do you look at when you are about to shoot someone?
Well, I photograph people, but the... what. You know, be careful when you're in
is it this delicate situation.
When you're in a delicate situation in places like Washington, you can't say those words. No, seriously, I had a producer not write that words on a document around the White House, like shooting vantage points. You know, so, okay, and you need to change that before I get on the plane. I focus on their eyes and I focus on a conversation quickly. I either let them speak. Or I speak very quickly up front to find something that we can connect about. It's usually nothing to do with them or me it's just trying to find common ground as quick as you can. That's really what it is. I mean, the physicality will come. It's time between two people. Mm-hmm. Really, the camera just happens to be there.
And when you've got, say, for an American president, you've got 10 minutes to do some of your best work.
Yeah.
Like, where do you start? The weather? Sport?
Sport. It depends what they're into. There's always something that, you know, can connect us. That last portrait with Michelle and Barack in the Oval Office, not in the Oval Office, in the map room. It was meant to be a story about them as a couple, on cover of a magazine, and it's their story, their human story. And so you can't talk about politics. The last thing they want to do, the hardest thing I get is I've gone from a really intense meeting can you imagine waking up as president? The things that are coming at you, like if you really know what you're doing, coming at you, are insane. So you go from intense, and then intense, and then you walk into a photo shoot, and they don't always want to do the photo shoots. They know that they need to do it. They want to do it because it's important for them to keep telling their story and their agenda and getting their agenda across. So you've just got to break that. You've got to blow it open somehow. And that sometimes you've got to say something absurd, or some sort of a shared experience. There was a great, I think the thing I said to him at that time, Australia had, the women and the men had just gotten flogged by the Americans in basketball. And, we all know he's a massive basketball fan. I was like, this is ridiculous. Can you guys give us a break? Like, really, 2 in 2 days? You're America, where's little Australia? And I was expecting him to say something endearing, and he let out this, like, crazy laugh. He said, yeah, we kicked your ass. That's great. I'm like, really? Thanks. Like, did you just really say that? So we broke it down, to get them to be two people. I had 6 minutes in that shoot.
Six.
And that day off, we went to photograph them in the Rose Garden. And then the weather turned, and then the first lady's person was saying, well, I don't really want to take her out. So it wasn't going to rain, but it was just a threat of it. But they wouldn't make the decision until 20 minutes before. So I had to set up for the Rose Garden. I had to set up for the interior. I had to set up for all these scenarios, and there's a lot happening in a few minutes.
We love the craft of what people do and really trying to understand. When you look at someone's eyes, like, what do you see? Or do the eyes just tell you a story?
Yeah, the eyes tell you a story. It tells you their intent, how they're feeling, because you don't know what mood they're going to be in. Mm. On a certain day, you just don't know how they're going to react. It's just getting to them as quick as you can and just shutting out everything else and trying to get them to focus on you. You know, when I set up my equipment in places, I set up all sorts of decoy screens and lights that don't need to be there just to block out other people. You know, and quite often when I do, say I'm doing a photo shoot and I'll get really close to someone really quick. And I'm sure that's used by, I mean, I know that happens with other sort of power situations, but you just get really close to someone, you know, firm handshake and get in their eyes, you know, get them like, get their attention as quick as you can. And then, you know, either they don't want to be there and you'll know pretty quick or you're good.
People may be surprised to hear you speak about the importance of rapport. I guess, where does it stack up when you're talking about the technical side, the setup, everything like that, but the ability to win someone over as a person?
Sure. It's everything. Yeah. It's absolutely everything. I mean, people sort of forget that it's people photography. Right? So the people comes before photography for a reason. You know, to be honest, the camera just happens to be around. You know, I try very hard to take pictures that you could feel like you're in the room, you feel like you're having a conversation with these people. And that, if I come away with that, I've achieved it. And it really happens, just happens to be a camera in the room. I mean, to me, the photography has become the least important, not the least important part, but the easiest part. Yeah. I don't really care about it. I mean, I do care. I have to have a product, but.
So in terms of the finished product then, mm-hmm. and you look at two portraits, one you've had great rapport and perhaps the other not so much. What's the actual visual difference between the two that you would notice as a true technician?
I mean, not having good rapport is actually sometimes, if there's tension, I'm happy. Mm. You know, if there's a problem, I'm really happy. You know, I spent a day photographing a Republican congressman in the Capitol building, had some really interesting, odd conversations. And I actually sometimes prefer when I probably don't agree with someone politically because I'm going to get a better result. So a problem is fine. A great connection is great. In the middle, when there's just that empty space, that's terrible.
So you want emotion. That's what you're looking
for. You just need
for.
A connection, you know, whether it's good or bad. You just need to find something.
Looking at the Obama versus Trump pictures, mm-hmm. I couldn't help but want to know about hands.
Mm-hmm.
And faces are important, but hands seem to also tell a huge story. Obama's hands and arms are crossed, sleeves are rolled up, so that iconic, you know, it's, appears to be down-to-earth Obama. And then Trump had kind of this this diamond-shaped kind
which,
of...
Which Michelle has in some of her pictures too.
Does she? But with the Trump thing, it was like just this almost missile. You know, it's a bit topical, but...
Yes.
Can you just explain, do you prompt them to use their hands or that's just them?
I let them be themselves. You know, I learned a really hard lesson once. I went to the Toronto Film Festival with Premiere Magazine. I had to photograph all these A-list actors walking into a room and I thought I was the boss, you know, but you're not the boss. You want them to be themselves. So, and I had these moments where I was telling, you know, serious actors to do this and they're like, no, I'm not doing that. And I didn't have a plan B. So then I got, you know, I was crushed. It was not a very good experience. Then I went and put myself through improv comedy school, which was, you know, I was the worst person in the room. It didn't matter. I wasn't there for that. It's just letting people, you know, the golden rule of improv is yes and. You let people build to find out who they are and you listen. So, yeah, I go in with what I want them to do, but if they're giving me something that is naturally them, that's far better than any sort of controlling thing I can do. But in terms of the difference between Obama is a much more guarded person. You have to really...
Is he?
He's very guarded. Yeah, he is. You know, he comes across as that professor in the room. He is, I wouldn't say cold, but he's, you know, I mean, the times I've been with him, he's just about to clinch the nomination and he's the president in the White House. So you can only expect to break it down so much. Whereas Trump, I'd photographed him a number of times at his residence in New York and he wasn't president at that point, you know, and I just, you know, I think the prompts for that were like, this is the biggest house in the world. He's like, yeah, it's the biggest. Oh, this is the greatest rooftop. It's the greatest. You know, and he's like, are you fired? And he couldn't wait to do the you're fired with me, you know. So he's an easier sort of hot air. We talk about it. He's like a hot air balloon of ego and you can really push it around far too easily, which... It's a bit of a worry, but he's also come from he has made his name because of television, and be a larger than life character, so that's what he knows is what he's going to do. Where you know Obama is a thinker, and you know the greatest thing with Obama is you ever get Michelle in the room, and he changes immediately, and that happens usually with you know spouses.
Feels more comfortable.
Oh, immediately. You know, I mean, Mitt Romney was a cardboard cutout. The minute Anne walked in the room, he was a different person, you know. That usually happens. Most when someone comes in the room they're happy to be with and makes a massive difference, which is good.
Do you feel that the power of political portraiture is that for all these reasons is that people want to know a little bit behind the TV camera? They want to know behind the spin, and what they're asking for in a portrait is give me some of that realness.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're all so politics, sport, everything has gotten so driven by data and advisors, don't say this, don't say that, to the point that people say nothing, you know, and we want to know who these people are, you know. I think that problems is the last sort of political season, but, you know, one candidate wouldn't talk to the media, was decided to shut down and was fearful of media because of this history, but you didn't get to know, like no one knew who she was. You know, Obama opened up in smart ways, enough, not too much. You know, Bill Clinton, you know, knew that let me be Bill, warts and all, you know, and that'd be much more endearing to other people to be that person. So, yeah, we're all stretching for it. You know, the advisors are still there. Everything's poll-driven, but if you can get there, that's my goal, is to try to break that open. Mm. And that's why that rapport and that connection, because maybe I can get them to say, come with me to this game, come to me with the airport, my job is, their magazine can only get me in the door. It's my job to get through the next door. You know?
And that can happen.
Sure, it can happen. Yeah, absolutely.
They'll say we like, just keep following
us. Yeah. I have plenty of time. So one senator is just after 9/11, and Senator Max Cleland from Georgia, and he triple amputee. He was a Vietnam vet, incredible, amazing story. And he was getting a viewing of the Pentagon as like a week after it'd been blown to bits. And, you know, all the advisors, you can't bring Ben in. Like, you cannot have, it's like, no, he's coming with me. I like the guy, you know. And so many times I've had, you know, magazines. It's a big relationship I'm trusted with. When a magazine has gotten a president to commit to a cover, that's taken months. It's taken, everyone in that magazine knows that I have him from 9/10 to 9/20. So there's a little bit of pressure. But that relationship is everything. So they need to get back in there the next time. So as much as I'm fighting and pushing to get the shot, and if I have to piss people off, I will. But I also have to maintain, you know, because they will request, like, get Ben back. You know?
So how do you maintain these relationships then? Because you have a creative responsibility to, sure. you want to do your job. And I'd imagine that, you know, you've got advisors in your ear. You may even have the president themselves wanting to push a certain angle. How do you kind of manage that kind of mix?
Yeah, it's a juggle, because I don't want to. My job is I don't work for the person I'm photographing. I don't work for the publicist in the room. I work for a magazine editor, and my job is to get that. And if they say, you know, like, if someone's got their shoelaces undone, or they got their fly down, or they got some wacky hair thing they haven't figured out, it's not my job to tell them. You know, it's really not my job. So, you know, if they spot it, they spot it. If you know, if they've shot in a more vulnerable way, like we photographed Senator McCain a few months ago, prior to the news about his health, and you know, he's got a big scar from previous cancer, and I did a real close up of his, you know, side of his head, and he was really upset. He called the magazine and said, "Why would you have to do that?" And I'd photographed him numerous times before, and I like the guy. Generally, I've never really had people incredibly upset. You know, Mitt Romney and his team wouldn't let me photograph this. You know, he's portrayed as the big rich billionaire out of touch, and I get invited to his crazy New Hampshire holiday house. And his team were really, they weren't very kind or even professional the way they dealt with me initially. And that put me offside. And then, you know, they said, just as long as you don't show the fancy house, we can't have the billionaire with the house. I was like, okay, well, that's what I'm going to do, you know. And in the end, yeah, I didn't get a lot of blowback from the story, but it's fine. It's what they are. You know, I had a you know, seamless background, and they said, hey, can you see the house? No. Get me the wide lens, you know, but... Yeah, my job is to get that shot, but you still have to maintain some, you know, I try to send gift prints to people afterwards, the subjects, to keep that relationship going. Mm-hmm. You know, I sent Trump some gift prints. He sent me back a crazy thank you letter on his like crazy gold leaf, which was kind of funny, you know. I mean, I've given gift prints to the president. You sign them and give them extras back, which is means a lot, you know. Yeah, there's relationships to everything, and you've got to realize it's a long game. So
The Bush portrait, I noticed, he seemed old.
Yeah,
and wrinkled. And how do you make a decision as to whether you capture that, you know, kind of more perfect image versus something which shows the flaws?
Oh, I go for the flaws. You know, again, what you asked before about, you know, trying to connect with someone, the more you realize they're normal people, that's the better off we all are. But I think the better off they are. Everyone is happy. No, I don't go intentionally to take someone down, but if they've got you know, like Bill Clinton, when I photographed him, was a really fragile older man, you know. So, no, I don't hold back in that situation at all, no.
How are you influenced by the history of portraits? I mean, it's portraits are ingrained in our history.
Yes.
Like, how often do you refer back to iconic pieces of many years gone by?
Yeah, incredibly so. I mean, I don't see my – what I do is I am taking the picture for the magazine, but I'm really taking the picture as it's a historical document, and I need to approach it like that. So if I'm photographing someone with – I try to take away elements that would date an image. To me, the greatest compliment would be to pick for maybe – kids in the future pick up a school textbook or a school website, whatever they got, and my picture exists as that picture. There's a really famous photographer, Yusuf Karsh, a Canadian photographer. You have seen the images. There's a famous picture of Churchill sort of standing there, all regal, black and white. And there's a famous picture where he pulled the cigar out of his hands and there's a scowl. And so Yusuf Karsh was like the great portrait photographer of the 40s and early 50s. The picture we all recognize as... Sir Edmund Hillary, Albert Einstein, you know, those characters, if you literally, you Google them, that will be the first image that comes up, you know, as well as Churchill. So if you've achieved that, then you've done your job. I have one picture of Rupert Murdoch in the National Portrait Gallery in the collection there, which means the world, you know, so. Because magazine work, media work is so consumed. It's so consumed so quickly. So I do a lot of research. I'm an incredible amount of research of you know, the starting point of these images and how we use them as a starting point, and then we try to find a place that sits amongst it.
Yeah, so what are you researching?
Photography. Yeah. I mean, great photography, great painting. You know, you go to museums. I won't move apartments because my book collection is too big. But it's really, 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 really important. And you'll find, you know, like music, there's only so... To come up with a new way of working is so hard. So you've got to find... Not borrow, but find ways that it's been that those stories have been told before, and it does help. Gives you a starting point, gives you a reference point for the magazine. It also gives you a reference point for the subject. When I say, I love these great pictures of Kennedy on his sailboat. You know, can we go out? You've got a boat. Let's go. And you know, so they're thinking, oh, Kennedy, that's great. Let's get on a boat. Like, it actually can help you in many ways. But yeah, no, I'm not. You know, I think I've had editors say, you know, It works very, like, it's solid. It's not today. I'm like, I'm not shooting for today. I am shooting for today, but I'm shooting for a lot longer, you know?
So. The history of the portrait I heard somewhere, I think it might have been at an art gallery, and it was when paintings were done that there was a sort of a big hoo-ha because people started not to paint them on the side, but suddenly sort of subtly bring their face around a little bit. And back in the day that was like, radical.
Yes.
Have you gone to those lengths in terms of, you know, where the origins of portraiture and where it all began?
Not deep enough. I should dig in deeper. Who was one of these Spanish painters who he was you know, in those situations you were definitely commissioned by these great painters to come in to depict these royal families, and your life depended that they look good. There was one of these Spanish painters who started. He was obviously getting annoyed with them. He slowly started putting in little things like their faults and flaws, and it's an amazing series. There's an amazing painter, the Spanish muralist Diego Rivera. If you go to Detroit, there's this amazing room in the Detroit Institute of Art. When Ford Motor invented the factory line, and it was changed the world and everything. He came in and he was commissioned to depict this modern marvel, and he actually came in and depicted the drudgery and how terrible it is being stuck on a production line 12 hours a day, and how humans are not humans anymore when they do that kind of work. And it created such controversy. And thank God it's still there, you know, because it's important that those statements are made. Yeah.
What was the first image, photographic image that kind of ignited this for you?
The world of portraits or the love of photography?
Oh, probably just photography, yeah. The moment when you were younger where you realised that this picture had an impact on you.
Pretty good question, isn't it? An image. Yeah, there is. Well, you've got me stumped. Because there's so much now, it's just so much imagery.
My example was my mum for my 21st bought me Max Stupain's
that's the iconic. So for me, good
but,
on your mum.
But it was, yeah, but that was, there. Yeah, because we went to the art gallery and I just said to mum, I thought that's just an epic image. I don't know what it is, but and I was quite young, I was just like that. So I guess for me, that sort of imprinted in my mind as to kind of that first time that a picture really affected me.
Yeah. I mean, maybe some of the. I definitely got into music as a young kid, and all the Beatles pictures and the John Lennon pictures. And when I realised what happened to John Lennon, some of those pictures created, you know, they made it important. You know, that picture of John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And then I found out the story that, you know, Annie had photographed him that day. You know, she was in the Dakota Building that morning. So those pictures become, you know, the D-Day pictures. I think I remember seeing those famous pictures of those black and white pictures on the landing of D-Day. And the historical story of that, where the photographer survived it. Got the film back to the UK, gave it to the kid in the processing place, and part of the processing, he did it at the wrong temperature, and he destroyed much of it. But what survived increased the contrast dramatically. So that's why those pictures are it's seemingly like insane levels of contrast, because they're actually a mistake, but it actually enhances the work, yeah.
Can you take us back to your formative years then?
Sure.
What was life for you growing up?
So I grew up here in Adelaide, born in Blackwood. My parents lived in Adelaide for many years. Both my parents come from social work background, and then my dad had spent years working in the Northern Territory in Aboriginal communities as a mediator for the Northern Territory Land Council, and that was really sort of, I was very lucky, it was very formative for me. We were in Adelaide and we went back there, so I spent many, many years as a kid, and I was lucky that Dad would take me out bush, and we'd drive through Arnhem Land or different communities that he would literally sit down and say, you know, between Aboriginal communities, land disputes, or between Aboriginal communities and white interests, be it mining or just, you know, because they say, as we all know, that's very sensitive information that can only be shared within certain communities. So I was really lucky to be up there and as a kid just literally sit around and go, you know, that sort of blew my mind in terms of you can do anything in the world. You know, your job can be lots of different things. You can meet all these great people, and that helped form it.
It's a fascinating way to grow up, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but for you to be able to learn, you're talking about rapport earlier,
yes,
and seeing relationships and mediation of relationships, very sensitive issues. Do you think that any of that has kind of like impacted you now?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't realise as a, you know, 12, 14-year-old kid, but you're sitting there going, 10 to 12, 14-year-old kid, but you're sitting, you know, you just realise like this is how, like there will be times where, you know, Dad would be like, you know, just keep quiet, do this, speak up. And I'd watch, you know, most of the important things he was doing were not the key words, you know, it was relationships and trust, you know, especially in remote Aboriginal communities. He's the white guy coming in. He needs to build trust very quickly.
With that experience as a child and the Australian outback, is it difficult to communicate to some Americans who kind of haven't left their little bubble? Yes. As to the way other parts of the world can be?
Yeah, no, I've had some very interesting conversations with Americans are really kind people who want to learn. They are curious. You know, they say Americans are not curious. They are curious, but they've not been given the base to ask the right questions. So, yeah, we've like, you know, the classic situations I've had many times. I've even had twice. It was once in Florida and once in California where I've had really great conversations with there were women. One ran a baseball, you know, hitting range. We were hitting after a photo shoot, and a waitress in California, and they both said, "I just want to let you know that your English is very, very good for an Australian." I said, "Thank you very much. I've been working on it for a while." You know, like, what do you say? But and it wasn't delivered in it was delivered in the sweetest way possible. So yeah, there's definitely been some sheltered auras in the middle of Wyoming, and there was a cowboy. You know, real legitimate cowboy who's, I can't go to Australia. It's too young and you're going to get killed. They've had Shark Week and Alligator Week or whatever, like Spider Week and Snake Week. And of course, we rank on all those lists, you know. I'm like, you're a real cowboy in the middle of Wyoming. You're going to be fine, you know. So, yeah, it's funny. We had those conversations, yeah.
And do you think that Aussie charm is an effective weapon for you in the States?
Sure, it helps. Yeah. You know, you're not a threat. You know, I definitely had one time where a really powerful story photographing young children in kids whose parents served in Iraq, and it was really tough. It was one of the big the peak of the Iraq War, when you know men, service American men and women were dying at a terrible rate, and it was a story for a magazine photographing these kids. And literally, the school—if you had a, you know, a star on the wall—that meant your parent had died. You know, I mean, it's moving now to even think about it. And I was going on base. No parents, kids who had both parents in Iraq. You know, like imagine dealing with that. But there was a good, there was a fairly strong support group. And then the woman who was the liaison on the base, she's like, "Oh, great, where are you from?" Australia. She goes, "Oh, that's great." I said, "Well, what wouldn't be great?" She goes, "Oh, if you're French." You know? So it's like, okay. But, you know, there is a positive thing. We are fortunate to have that people do think highly of. Many times I photographed Vietnam veterans from Senator McCain, Max Cleland, John Kerry. And it's been really amazing to have them say, "Where are you from?" "I'm Australian." And they've just gone, "Oh, you guys were the best." And they said, McCain, they both said the same story. They're like, "You guys were the toughest in the trenches, but somehow you always popped up with a beer in your hand." It's like a mental, yeah, it meant a lot. You feel really good when you hear those stories.
Yeah.
You must have an amazing collection of stories. It must be this amazing bonus about what you do. I imagine you're just collecting stories on the road.
Yes. Yeah, they are. For years, my father keeps pushing me to write them down. And I have them there, and we're just starting to write them down before I get too old. But it is the joy of the experience. And I can't tell an editor this, but to be honest, I have to have a good result for the product, for the magazine to rehire me. But I don't really, the camera, it's actually a bonus. If the picture's strong, there was a life-changing moment here in Australia. I went to a 19-year-old photo kid. I went to a photo conference with all these legendary photographers in a winery, and this one old photographer, legend, old guy from Melbourne, kept getting group shots of all these photographers together. "Go over here, you go over there." And Ian was like, "Hey, you know, I'd love to get a print. I'm with like a lot of my heroes and photographers in Australia." And he's like, no, I can't give them to your kid. And I was like, "Oh, well, I'll print them. You know, you don't have to do anything. I'll just come to your dark room and print them." And he said, no. And if I kept badgering him, he's like, "Mate, I don't put film in the camera anymore." It took me a while to figure it out. You know, it's obviously pre-digital days. He just loved the process of getting people to come together for a group. He didn't want the result, didn't need the result. He just loved the process. Still blows my mind. But it really did change what, like, it made me think so hard about why you do things, you know. So I love taking pictures. I love that experience.
How ambitious were you at that age to crack this field?
At a very young age, well, I was very, very, very lucky. I worked for an amazing young group of photographers, Mike and Essie, Chris Otto, who took a 18-year-old kid who didn't really know what he's doing and gave him a chance. Looked after me there. I went to Sydney, worked for a big advertising photographer. I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, I mean, I knew what I was doing, but and then I sort of tired of that and went overseas and to South America traveling because I had I just needed to get away from as far away from work as possible. Thinking I was going to be a herding llamas in Bolivia. I came pretty close to that. And then got to New York and I was meant to go to Europe actually, but I didn't get past the city.
But just to come back to that, how did you lob in New York?
Bought a stack of tickets and tried to figure out how to get there. And, you know, it's like the universe works, you know, relationships are everything and friendships are everything. And even if you don't know, if you come in with the right bit of naivety, but a bit of, you know, the right attitude and you're humble and you're honest and you give your best. That's all you can do. And New Yorkers are a pretty receptive bunch of that. That city has had this amazing history, as famous as it is and the greatest people in the world. It's had this incredible history. It's a port city. So it's had this amazing history of people coming and going. Most New Yorkers are not New Yorkers. You know, they're from somewhere else anyway. So they do like to see someone else coming in and do well. They always give you a chance. New Yorkers will give you a crack. There's so many stories of people reinventing themselves from all the way back to now. And that's the climate, and I'm really grateful that city does that. No one's ever asked me, "Who's your family? Where'd you go to school?" What they're really asking, like, "What can you do for me?" And that's fine. You just need a chance, right?
I'm not sure if it's called an internship or you became an assistant to the famous Annie Leibovitz.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that set you up for the next phase?
It helps, definitely helps. I came through, it's really interesting, it was a really interesting to look back on. So again, I came in, had a friend who was a young photographer, Sebastian Thor, who's really good friends with the studio manager, and those sort of places are always looking for different help, maybe. So I came into New York, and Annie, she's like, "Oh, do you want to go to Annie's studio?" Like, they're interviewing people because they've got a new big project. And I thought that'd be funny. I'd just meet someone famous and leave, you know. And then I went in and the first assistants, you know, but I'd just gotten off a year in South America. So I was really in a different headspace. And I think it's a really good thing for us to remember. So I came in, you know, and I have my few little pictures, which I look back now, they're pretty terrible. But the first assistant, second assistant said, oh, yeah, pretty good. Let me get the first assistant. And I'm like, this is pretty funny. And I got a first assistant who's now a really famous photographer in New York. And he's like, oh, let me get Annie out. Oh, this is pretty cool. And Annie came in and she asked me a couple of, you know, very obvious basic questions. And I know, I look back, I was like, is this, I gave her the weirdest answers because I really wasn't in New York time. I wasn't in New York speed. And she took a liking because she's a, you know, runs to a different beat as well. She's an artist and she grew up as a kid from an army family and she traveled around. And I came in with a different way of thinking about things maybe. I didn't even know it. And then she's like, yeah, what are you doing tomorrow? And I think I pretended that I was, well, let me look at the schedule. I don't know if I can work on a Vanity Fair cover shoot. Yeah, I can do that. And then I put my head down. She gave me a full-time job. I worked there for a year. And then from there, but, you know, I found out later there was these really intense New Yorkers who didn't get that job. You're the guy. I'm like, yeah. Because they were obviously came in with, like, New York hat on. Mm-hmm. They were so stressed out and so almost, like, maybe burnt out, you know. Mm. And I came in with that. Just a different point of view. Made a difference.
So what did you learn from a legend? What were the key kind of takeaways?
That everything counts, you know, everything counts. Everything you do counts. People would say, what is the one thing that made her the greatest photographer in the world? And you kind of laugh and you go, well, it's the 100 things. You know, it's the 100 things that she does well. She's incredibly... I mean, she's a phenomenal talent. For someone who has had 40 years of really defining American history and world history, getting these moments from people who are the most guarded and the most known, she has this amazing ability to dig that out of her. And if you met her here at interview, she'd be quite – you would struggle to communicate with her. But when she's in that universe, I think she's a different – you know, she's almost like stepping on stage. I learned that everything counts. Everything she does well, that the people she hires are the best people in the world. She hires the kindest people. I mean, the hardest working, you know, everything about those people that she hires is she's amazing at picking that. And she's relentless. You know, I always joke about being on a, like, what's it like working there? I'm like, well, it's like being on a runaway, you know, freight train. When you're on the train, it's great. You know, getting on and off is pretty bumpy. But once you're on it, and if you're committed to working at the speed she's working at, life's good. The minute you waver, you know, it's not a good moment.
So what do you mean by the speed? Is it just she's just throwing a lot of things at the team and you kind of just got to roll with it, or like kind of?
Sure, she expects a lot. I mean, what she expects of you is incredible, but it's relentless. I mean, I replaced a Canadian photo assistant who had been in a car accident. He was not injured greatly, but he just couldn't physically keep up with the day. I mean, you will get on a plane, you will go to LA at, you know, 6 a.m, you will set up a massive studio shoot, you know, who a celebrity comes in, you wrap that down, you get on a plane, you go to Paris, you set that up, you wrap that down, you get on, and she will, if you show one ounce of weakness, she's going to strike. And I mean that kindly. I mean, she taught me, I'd already learned the basics of the core photographic skills. She didn't teach me anything about how to take a picture, but how you approach everything. You know, how you focus on everything you do.
So you have this amazing opportunity. Mm. What moment or what job though then do you feel like you're now out on your own and I'm beginning to kind of crack this thing open myself? Was there a job where you felt was a bit of a catalyst?
Yeah, there are jobs, yeah. I mean, so just to go back a little bit, so I worked for Annie and then I worked for other heroes of mine, Mary Ellen Mark Seliger, who shot that Cobain stuff, really famous Vanity Fair Rolling Stone guy. And then one guy I worked for, Harry Benson, if you see the footage of the Beatles getting off the plane. Yep. Harry, I love Harry. He's the meanest, sweetest, I don't know, son of a bitch you can say. Like, he is the greatest man alive. Like, he spent, there isn't a moment in American history, world history, that the man could sit at a table with kings, queens and presidents and run that table.
Did the amazing Dylan stuff.
Yeah, he probably, yeah, I'm sure he did. Yeah, yeah, Harry was there with everyone. Yeah. I mean, he was with the Beatles, that famous picture of them having a pillow fight.
Yep.
I Want to Hold Your Hand, hit number one there in Paris, you know. But that man comes from the years of life. I got to travel with Harry and he taught me so much. Besides, you know, if I showed up without my tie, I had to wear a suit and tie. I was on a race course, racetrack, 110 degrees, and I didn't take I didn't bring the tie and he cursed me out. And I was like, Harry, come on, man. It's like, you know, we have standards here, Harry. But he came from that world of, getting that shot. You know, I mean, he got the shot. He was in the bathroom. No, he was in the kitchen above Bobby Kennedy while Bobby Kennedy lays dying, you know, being shot. Like, there isn't a moment in American history that Harry hasn't witnessed. There's a documentary out now. Please watch it.
I saw it, I'm not sure if it's the same one, but part of it was also talking about the, you know, he got the Beatles to go and meet Muhammad Ali. They were just all in the same city at the same time. And he said, there's only one photographer in the world that could have brought those two sets of egos together and made it work.
Yeah.
And he did that.
I'm so incredibly grateful. And he's the kindest. Yeah, he's just an amazing, amazing. So I learned more. Probably the person I look back now and I'm so much more grateful to spend the time with was Harry, because he just says, you've got to step up. So your question about going and getting out my own, you know, I had that early experience at the Toronto Film Festival, which was tough. And then I don't know if there was one shoot, definitely the Obama shoot, the first Obama shoot, where that really changed editors' perceptions. A lot of editors wouldn't hire me, and then that came out and they just went, you know, would you, you know, from then on the phone wouldn't stop ringing, because, you know, what other people weren't sure I could do was prove that I can, you know. And it's my set, you know. I was talking to someone the other day about, they're like, well, how do you talk to these people? How do you deal with these people? It is my set. This is your show. Like, this, their office. You need to own it. And as long as you got that, then, you know, they're looking to you for that direction. Yeah.
In terms of stepping out on your own, I guess, was it a challenge to make that jump? I mean, you're under the wing of legends. You're working with photography royalty. There must have been a temptation to say, you know what, this is pretty good.
Yeah, there is. I mean, you can also be a burnt out 40-year-old photo assistant in New York City, and that doesn't seem like a lot of fun for me. You know, I didn't go there to be a photo assistant. I went there to be a photographer. The joy of creating is something that I think, you know, I wanted to keep doing. So, you know, at some point I had this amazing test. It was really interesting. You know, we have a bit of a safety net, but I realized, you know, I just need to be a photographer. At some point, saying, I'm not a photo assistant, I'm not this, I have to be that. And people have to perceive me as that. And everyone's lives and whatever work they're doing, you have to say, this is the moment. And it is pretty scary, but what else are you going to do? Why? I didn't go to New York to hang around. You know, I love Australia. I love my family. I didn't go there just to escape. I went there to try to do something. So if you're going to do it, go for it. You know, I am going to sink or swim. And, you know, money got pretty tight there for a few weeks. There was a few months of this is the budget for the food for the week, and let's see what you can do. But, you know, I look back now and they're the stories we always love, you know, like, well, I didn't have this and I survived on that. But you can. It's amazing what you can get through if you see the bigger picture or hope the bigger picture is going to come, you know.
Read about some amazing parties in New York, you know, and they would consist of, you know, amazing artists and writers, Norman Mailer, you've got, you know, Jackie O coming in. So you've kind of got this melting pot of people, you know, at the top of their game.
Yes.
Does that still occur? Do you still get invited to moments where you're building your network across rather than up and down?
Sometimes, yeah. No, definitely it's important thing to be able to bring people together. The greatest thing about New York, which you don't get in most other cities, I don't think you get in any other city in the world, maybe London, definitely don't get it in DC or LA, is because you can go to a dinner in DC, in New York, and you can have the UN, you know, a person working at the UN, you can have a scientist, you can have a Wall Street guy, you can have a photographer, you can have a painter, and that's what creates these amazing, you know, I've got a friend who's a software developer, and he, you know, hosts these interesting dinners like that we really, it's really fascinating because you can really go across, you know, different ways. It does help. That the relationships are everything, you know, to get, you know, like I have kept in touch with Charlie Rose and a few other people, and to be able to go in and just be able to sit down I don't get to come up and have beers on a Tuesday, but those relationships are everything. Yeah, absolutely.
And I read somewhere that Kanye just decided to lob on your doorstep and
he did.
What was the story there?
So we were photographing Philip Lim and Alexa Chung, who's sort of a model muse. And we were doing a story. Fortune magazine has, for a number of years, they sent me away and did a luxury portfolio. It was the greatest summer project because I would photograph the world of fashion from a business point of view, not so much a fashion point of view. And, you know, obviously they're fashion people. You know, I went to Paris and to Milan and, you know, the Xenia families and the, you know, all these different, you know, legends of the fashion world in London and the Burberry crew. And then so Philip Lim was an interesting story because in the downturn in the fashion world, his brand kept going because his partner knew how to navigate the production in China, knew how to make. And so besides he covered the ground from middle to high. But your question's about Kanye. So, you know, you go in and it's a story about him. What we're trying to, your question earlier about research, right? So we've done a lot of research on famous designers and their muses. And there's great stories, you know, in Paris, you know, Atelier, where they're working with these legendary, you know, models of whatever decade. Let's do a modern take on that. And that's why we put those two together. And then, you know, it was a very, very difficult shoot to navigate because of the room itself was hard to light. I had no time. I'm looking around and then, you know, I'm sort of had limited time. And then I sort of caught him to my right. I'm like, oh, who's that? Like everyone's attention in the room just looked to the right. I'm like, oh, I know who that is. And then the editor, of course, is like, you got to get him. I'm like, I got it. Oh, thanks. Okay. And then he was coming in because Philip Lim had designed a suit for him for some event. And then, you know, I just quickly went to his manager who had met his manager, reps other hip hop people I'd worked with other on shoots. And I said, got to get him in. But you can always, Kanye was promoting an album, just happened to have an album coming out in 2 months. He did it. Yeah. But of course, there was these moments. Of course, Kanye had to come in and run the show. And we're like, can you sit on this? Can you do this? It's like, we didn't want him to upstage, just to upset everyone. But then, of course, Kanye, like, took over, and then there's this weird thing where he's like, what if I've got the jacket open and she's down on her knees? I'm like, no, she won't be. So, it was interesting moments.
Yeah. I thought you were trained to say yes and.
Always yes and. But I had a team of publicists, and I had Alexa Chung look at me like, no. I actually think we did do a few frames with her just to appease him. I was like, Kanye, kind of looks a little... little off here. So,
I guess in terms of the many celebrities, powerful people that you've spent time with, who were the people that have really left an impression on you or really stuck with you for whatever reason, good or bad?
Sure. Impression. Senator Max Cleland, who was that triple amputee from Vietnam, who I spent a few days with, besides going to the Pentagon. I mean, I spent time with him with Vietnam veterans. We went to the Vietnam veteran, the museum, the wall, the Vietnam Veterans Museum wall in DC. And I had two 50-year-old men break down and cry, hugging him, you know, in the middle of the mall in Washington. And that, you know, was just, you know, takes a moment to, if you think about that. Getting time with, I went as a photo assistant. Actually, one time we went and photographed a white supremacist in a compound in West Virginia. And I was working with a German photographer who was West German photographer who was really on edge. Sometimes when you're photographing, and this man was photographed by Rolling Stone magazine for spreading, you know, the incredible hate speech, and, you know, he had really sort of brainwashed all these young men in this compound, and that was really hard to be in those moments. Of course, with, like, what do they say? Something like, oh, who's this? These are the guys from Rolling Stone magazine, and they're like, these are the F word from, these are the you know, like, it's gay, you can swear, gay
you can, slur. You can,
I can slur.
You
here.
Can swear on this radio.
They're like, you know, these are these faggots from Rolling Stone magazine, you know, and these are men standing around with machine guns and knives, and, you know, Marty had dreadlocks, and I'm, you know, my wife's black, and all that. So all these situations, all these racial and sexual stuff that you're going on, and you're really, they set up this world of intimidated. They were trying to intimidate us in ways, and it was really quite scary. But, you know, they wanted their picture taken just like everyone else does.
So what do you draw on in those challenging times, whether it's the emotional side or whether it's having to photograph Obama in 6 minutes? When the heat's on, when the pressure's on, what is it that you're drawing on to make sure that, irrespective of the circumstances, you can get the job done?
Just focus on your job, the nuts and bolts, you know. I've had plenty of shoots when everything is swirling and things seem out of control, but you just have to keep it together. And, you know, if you just focus on those little steps in front of you, the big picture will take care of itself. You have to go in with a big picture view, but you must break it down. You must focus on this, and then if I get through this, then I can get through that. If I get through that, I can get through this, which is obvious things that we deal with every day, situations to solve a critical, you know. I always think of You know, if you've seen The Making of Apocalypse Now, Hearts of Darkness, when Coppola made that film, I mean, if he made that film against all odds, Monsoons took out film sets. Marlon Brando showed up 100 pounds overweight. You know, Martin Sheen had a heart attack on set. He had the Philippine military take away the helicopters in the middle of those scenes. And that man somehow just kept going along. Like, if he can do that, well, we can get a little photo shoot done.
Yeah. Is that something that you've always been good at, or is that something that you've had to learn along the way?
You've had to learn. Yeah, you can't get rattled, and you can never, ever get rattled. And if you are rattled, you never show it. You know, I've had plenty of times when I'm smiling, joking to the, you know, to the subject of politician, and I'm like, yeah, it's great, it's fantastic. I mean, actually, that first Obama assignment, we were in some cow shed in North Carolina State Fair grounds, and he'd made a speech, and we had set up, even that day, like, so I had agreed on this section of this area, I was going to shoot him, photograph him, and then someone took my section, and I was ready to have this big confrontation. I was like, Some other crew had taken, some TV crew, and I was like, nope, I'm not going to get rattled. I'm going to be just fine over there. I'm going to be fine in that corner. It doesn't matter. I'm not here. Where I shoot in this place is not going to make a difference. Anyway, and, you know, we always have plan B, C, and D, because you need to plan for what goes wrong, not typically will go right, you know. Comes in, we have, you know, seven sets. We had very limited time. I had to get him to this. And sure enough, we tested the power. Minute he steps in, the power went down. I'm like, you know, they're not going to hang around for me to get my power right. So I had three photo assistants screaming, running around me while I've still got the president in front of me. But, you know, we had thought about, okay, what if the power goes down? I have a little battery-powered light that's off to the corner of the set, you know, and I never even, you know, I never blinked. I never ever said, you never yell fire. You can't. You just have to keep going. I said, hey, you know, Brock, just come over here, man. You know, sit on that little chair, and I'm holding the light, guessing the setting on the pack, guessing the setting on the camera. I mean, it's not that hard, you know, and I'm just having a chat with him, and I think I got his attention. We're talking about the Iranian president, which we'd photographed the week before, you know, so I'm having this surreal moment, like, my assistants are spinning around the room. I got Obama. I'm telling him about Ahmadinejad, and he's telling me, like, what's he like, you know? I'm like, this is a really sort of a weird moment in the middle of the madness, but I kept him focused. I kept myself focused. Those pictures are beautiful. My my photo assistant came to me at the end of the shoot, and he was almost like crying. I'm sorry, I ruined your shoot. He was like, no, it's the greatest shoot ever, you know, because we kept it together. I don't think Obama knew what was going on. My editor at the end said, did something happen at the start there? I was like, yep, a few things happened. Like, literally, we had no juice to get this thing done. But
wow,
you plan. You got to plan for that.
Yeah.
So the mechanics of your team.
Yes.
What is your team consist of when you're flying out to do a shoot like that?
It's horses for courses. You know, I've had full-time photo assistants. I try to keep my crew small as I can, to keep it as mobile as I can. Not everyone wants to, you know, spend a day in Washington with a senator, and, you know, you have to love what you do, you know, but, and you have to be really, like, a lot of my photo assistants have to be, like, pretty mature guys who are paying attention, because my assistants can't make a mistake. On a typical photo shoot, you can make a mistake. You know, oh, we'll get the model to come back into the set. Well, there isn't a model that I can direct back in. They're trying to shake my hand to get out of the room. My job is to keep them in there and get more. So if a photo assistant hasn't paid attention to this radio transmitter not working, or this little pack going, or this happening, or even be the right type of person, because they look me up and down, they look my assistant up and down, and they judge us very quickly, you know, like, you know, I wear great suits. You know, I learned that from Harry. My assistants must wear great suits. Those situations, like how they handle themselves, the conversations they have, the way they hold, that is, to me, like, they have to be good photo technicians, but they have to be better people. They have to be mature, you know. I'm actually trying to find, I'm only looking forward to hire some of these ex-Marines that have come back, because I think they're probably going to, I'm trying to, like, figure out who's got a mate who's come back as a Marine who wants to learn to be a photographer. I think those guys would probably be the best.
Mm.
Well, they know how to stand still for a while, you know.
Why grey suits?
Great suits.
Grey suits. Oh, no, great suits. Something to do with the colour.
No, great suits. I do have a grey suit, a really nice suit. No, but that, you know, like, that's how, you know, you separate yourself from a pack.
Trump commented on your suit, didn't he?
Yeah. He got, I knew it was going to, and this was very predictable, but he did. You know, I had my, actually that day, I actually have a suit and tie at my studio. I have a whole suit set up in my studio for the photo assistant who thinks it's a joke, you know. And I go, no, it's not a joke, buddy. You have to put that on now. You know, I'll wear a chicken suit if it gives me 10 more minutes. I don't care, you know. Prefer not to. But they, you know, this isn't showed up with a great suit, and he showed up with, like, basketball shoes because he's a cool, hip, you know, Brooklyn kid. And I'm like, I don't care, bud. You're going to have to put these shoes on. So we show up, and sure enough, Trump walked in the room and just looked at my assistants up and down, looked me up and down, you know, and I've told this story before, but got really close. I know what you're doing. I know what you're doing. It's good. You keep this up. I was like, okay, thank you, Mr. Trump. It's just wearing it out of respect. I'm clearly wearing it. Yes, respect, but if I get
was
five
it
more
fat
minutes.
Tie and you had you boofed up your hair as well.
No, I kept it.
He wasn't mimicking you. He was just wearing a suit.
But you do have to, it's really interesting, you do have to dress well, but you don't want to dress better than.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you don't want to show them up.
I was going to talk about that power because it is one of those moments. You've got all these competing forces, publicists, the talent themselves. They're wanting to project something, but for those moments, they are surrendering themselves and they're at your disposal.
Yeah, sure.
And you are in a very powerful position.
Yeah, it's fine.
For moments.
Yeah, it's good.
Do you enjoy that?
Yeah, a little bit. It's amazing. It's amazing to see the fear in the eyes of a publicist when they hand you their principal. I did a whole portfolio with the board of directors of these, you know, the biggest companies in the world, and it was just fear. If you make a mistake, I'm going to get fired. You're not going to get fired, kid. But, you know, yeah, it is. It is that moment. It is my set, you know. And I actually now take really badly printed, not badly printed, but quick printed pictures of other people that they respect. Like when I photographed Bono, you know, we shot him as a group thing for this benefit project, and I know I needed to get my head shot, and his publicist is famous for being impossible. And, you know, I got Bono to the side and I was like, these are these people of power, and like, I need 2 minutes with you at the end, you know, and he jumped on it. You know, they give you, if they see the contemporaries or people they respect, they want to be included in that group as opposed to just another photo shoot. You know, of course, Bono sat in for me and the publicist ran over, what are you doing? And Bono's like, no, this guy's good, leave me alone, you know. So because I got connected to with them on their level. But yeah, I do. I mean, that moment of handing it over to me, that's why I said you've got to step up. You've got to own that space. You know, I also set up, hopefully publicists are not listening to this. If they are, I'm going to give it up. But I set up a lot of fake lights and sets and seamlesses. I put a lot of things in their way. And I tell my photo assistants, if they come over there, just tell them they're in the way of the light and they got to get out of the way. And because I don't want to say no to someone, right? So if you're standing, arguing with someone is not positive and it's a horrible, it creates a terrible situation. And they're going to try to maybe fight back. And I don't need that. I want to say yes to everything. I want people to be happy. So you're better off, instead of saying no, you say, I'm sorry, you're in the way of the light, you know? Mm. Or what I do quite often is even if I've got a big portrait of a subject in a big environmental setting and I'm further back, I would never take that picture first. I would take a close headshot first. If I was photographing you, I'd have you in the corner. I'd get really close. I'd get in your face and have a quick chat. I'd find something that I connect with. Then I've got you connected with me. I've gotten rid of the publicist. And then I'll go to the wider shot. Mm. You know, that's the game.
Do you get intimidated anymore?
No, you can't. You can't. I mean, it connects to everything else. You can't. You know, I had a moment. It's really helpful, actually. Rupert Murdoch was a really sweet guy. We photographed Rupert Murdoch on the roof of his Fox offices, you know, around then 6 and 42nd or, no, 52nd Fox News. And I was up there on the roof and it was 10 minutes and, you know, he said, oh, hey, how are you doing, Ben? Good. And he goes, I know you're great. I can tell you're great. You're going to be so great. You're gonna, you know, this is your shoot. And it wasn't saying it in a pumped up way. He just said, I'm confident in what you've got. He could tell I was a little bit nervous. You know, and there were great pictures. And I thank him for actually saying, step it up and you can't be nervous around me because I want you to get this done. Mm. Meanwhile, I had his Australian PR guy nudge me on the shoulder because I had him on a little box quite close to a ledge. You know, because my PR guy says, here's your chance, make yourself famous, mate. I did get Murdoch. I had him at ease because of Lachlan. I used to go to work in Sydney when Lachlan was an unmarried billionaire. Bachelor billionaire kid. I tried to go in a bar in Sydney and everyone's like, Lachlan's here with his posse. You're like, okay, well, I'll leave. No one's going to care if I'm in here. Then I went to New York and I was trying to Bungalow 8 and a really famous club. And we've somehow got ourselves in there. And there was a table and I was trying to show off in front of friends and get the table. And they're like, it's taken. And then Lachlan walked in. So I told Rupert, he's like, oh, yeah, that's my boy. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So, yeah.
What about the commercial aspects? This might be a little dry, but.
Oh, come on, mate. We're talking about the rich and famous. Yeah, I don't want the dry.
We'll get back to that. No, but I'm a bit fascinated. With all the logistics, I mean, do you have deals with magazines? How does the structure of the commercial angle work?
Sure. So I have an agent who has a good relationship with editors. And those editors, a photo editor will take my work to a creative director and then it'll go up the line. So that's pretty much what it is. As long as, you know, your relationship's strong with the photo editor and you have proven that you've delivered, and you have to over deliver. Once that happens and they're comfortable with you, you know, people can't hire rookies to do my job because of that stress. They need to know that in that 5 minutes I walk away with success, you know. So that's the relationship. So you have that relationship with magazines. And then advertising companies come on board because they like the magazine work or the personal work. And that sort of has to be maintained. And you make sure that when you have an editor who, you know, has looked after you, you look after them and you make sure you produce when you're on set.
You spoke about having this common thread of just wanting to create.
Yes.
That's what you want to do.
Yes.
How do you reconcile that against the business side? Like, do you hate invoicing out? Do you like, is that a real grating aspect of what you do?
Yeah, it's still a business. I mean, my father asked me once, you know, is it a business, and are you a photographer with a business, you know, or a business that takes photographs? And I thank him, even though he's not a businessman, but I thank him for keeping that in your head, because you are running a business. You do have to stay solvent in a world where, as creatives, you know, there has been this tendency for companies to take advantage of creative, saying they don't care, they just want to do it, which is unfortunate. You know, and things are changing. Technology's coming in and making it more competitive. And but it is, yeah, you might have to maintain that level. You know, you also need to fight to maintain, to have enough funding to do it well. You know, you can't produce. I've had small magazines and I love them, but they're like, they reference, you know, 10 of these pictures and they're like, we want this. I'm like, okay, but we're going to need to have the appropriate people to get that done, because I'll disappoint you if you don't help me with that.
Well, on the business of your world, how has photography changed with, you know, the advent of Instagram technology, stock photos,
yes,
iPhones,
filters?
Yeah, it's changed immensely. I mean, we're watching it change in front of us, you know, in front of our eyes, immensely. I think that. That the shift has happened so quickly that we still don't really know what's going on. I do think that the way that we consume media, buy media, sell media, has changed so much. And I do think the era of the photograph, the photograph of life, I think, will always be more powerful than every other medium. It's how we remember history will be defined by an image, even now in the middle of it changing. It has changed it radically. It's flooded the market in terms of, you know, everyone thinks they're a photographer, and they are. That's fine. I mean, the quality of images that come out of someone's iPhone is astonishing. Instagram has blown things open. But I still think there is always going to be a place for those whose craft has been honed. There are a billion photographers who think they could go in and do what I do, and they'd probably do a pretty good job. But people know that I don't choose a time I do a shoot. I don't choose how, where, why. I don't control any of those factors. But I'll come out, and I'll guarantee a success every time. Mm. You know, there'll be better days than some. I don't control everything, every factor. But so there is that. But it is changing. I mean, even things like, you know, magazine industry doesn't exist like it used to exist. Money that used to be spent on magazine advertising now is spent on Google and Facebook advertising. You know, here in Australia, if everyone is upset about the speed of the internet and the broadband, I know that argument is happening. I think it's fantastic. Keep it slow, because don't keep it slow, but it's held back, I think, the forces of that, because once that money was spent on what we would think of as a Mad Men campaign, this beautiful campaign with these principal characters, and, you know, spent all this money, and now data has taken over, and every agency, you know, client can say in real time, do we like someone wearing a red shirt? Oh, great. Let's change the ad to a green shirt in real time. That's insane. But it's what they do. If you're a client and it's your money spent on advertising, you're going to feel much better that you can see the data, you know, which is great for a client, but it's not great for creativity, you know.
Are the days gone where a kid from the outback, well, not from the outback, but, you know, from Australia, can travel around and lob in the US and forge a career like you have?
No, not at all. No. I think it's really wild. We're in this weird world where we are like, okay, technology's taking over and we're losing what we had, but there's never been a greater thirst for content in the history of the world. There's never been more channels in the world to get your images out there. But there is so much noise. You know, we're talking to photographers and we're like, why aren't these editors paying attention to, or this and this and this? And we all agree that it's just so much noise. You can't, they can't hear anything. So how do you get above that? And that's the great challenge for all of us, you know.
These incredible stories, huge personalities, you're in the middle of the buzz and then you fly back into Adelaide. What's the feeling as you head over the Adelaide Oval and you're about to land in Adelaide?
I'm thrilled. I get dinner with mum and dad, you know, that's what I miss it dearly. No, it's great to be home. I really do. I miss Adelaide a lot. You know, I usually come home in March for those amazing 2 weeks. It's a great creative hub. It really is. It, you know, the nature of the population and the scales hold things back a little bit. But I, you know, I always love coming back and I, you know, look forward to the great thing about coming back and shooting on that film, the rabbit that I was just on recently. I want to contribute to stories at home. So, and I get dinner at mum.
Conscious of your time. So we'll just,
I just want to ask one more though. I mean,
we've still got a little rapid fire.
Yeah. Yeah. But you've got on your front page of your, you got a tab dedicated to Aussie rules on your global website. Can you just explain what you've done for the Port Adelaide Footy Club?
Sure. I grew up also in Alberton. I grew up across the road from the Alberton Oval. There is a, if anyone visits the Alberton Oval, there is now a car park. That was our house. And when I found out that the house was...
So Alberton.
It's like the castle, you know. When Dad said, oh, come back again, we'll come back for a trip. I literally grew up across the road from there. I learned to kick a footy, you know, run around with a dog, ride my bike. And so I, you know, down on Dad's shoulders every game, you know, watching the footy. And that it was an Alberton before we entered the territory and we came back, but that was everything. I came back and we moved to Largs and played junior footy at districts. I tried out for Port Adelaide juniors and I think they very quickly said, you're a better photographer. Well, I wasn't a photographer. They're like, thanks kid, but get out. You know, I was like, the year of Wanganine, Cockatoo Collins, the Wakeland boys.
Amazing era.
Yeah, it was great. I was a really lucky kid to live through that whole time. And then, so over the years, I've known some of the people in the Port Footy Club. And then Jeff Robinson, who's an important story that needs to be remembered. Jeff Robinson has been an advertising guy, has been responsible for all the great advertising campaigns that have come out of this town the last 20 years. Jacobs Creek, Cooper's, you just name it. He was great. And he knew that he was on the marketing advisory board at the club. And he sort of pitched it to them. He had one of these great advertising moments where he had the board. He was doing this you know, slideshow of the PowerPoint of these faces. And he goes, everybody just turn around, look out the window, see the car park? It's where the kid grew up. And Jeff recounts the story because he's like, it was just like advertising magic. Like, you don't get that opportunity to spin a story like that. He goes, that's your kid. And so, you know, and so I got to come in and we spent a day. I flew, literally got off the plane from New York to Melbourne when it was pre-season and the players were it was one of these preseason games and they were literally waiting for me. I was like, had gotten, it was great. It was a day with those guys. And then I came and had a day here at the Alberton change rooms with a lot of the supporters. And it was just the community. Cause that is, I mean, I can talk about Port Adelaide as long as you like.
I love it. You've got a picture of Russell Ebert in there and he was one of my junior coaches and it's an incredible picture. Cause he's one of those ones that he kind of just looks like a warrior.
Oh, he's Russ. Yeah. No, it was a really great. It was a great day. I was really fortunate to go and have that day. It was one of those experiences that I looked around. My dad was chatting with Russell. You know, Patty was talking to Timmy. My brother was talking to Timmy Jennifer. It's just like these moments. And the boot starter who'd, you know, Alfie worked for 50 years. And it was one of those moments where I, again, had I lost the camera in the film, I would have cared. But, you know, it was that experience. Mm-hmm. It's those experiences as a photographer to come back to have that day. And so that campaign was that TV campaign that ran. Mm-hmm. And then sadly, it's important to put it out there, but Jeff Robinson, he passed away 4 days after I finished that and before the campaign ran. So it was really, we lost a legend of Australian advertising, Adelaide advertising and Australian advertising. And we lost a legend because he's just the sweetest, kindest man. He enabled artists. He really brought artists in and just would always say, I'm not the artist, you're the artist. You, You know, I'm just here to facilitate good work, great art being done and created. So it was, you know, it's tough to that campaign. It's, you know, it's a, as proud as I am, it's this really sad moment for you. But anyway, we're really proud of it. I'm in town. As an ambassador, I've been invited to all these games, and finally I get to go to a game this round versus Collingwood, and apparently the ad runs pre-game, so I can't wait to see that.
Wow.
And again, just share that moment. You know, I've got friends and family who'll be there. So
we have a regular section called Rapid Fire, which I'm notoriously very poor at delivering, but this one I kind of want to make it a little bit different. It's more of a punter's corner, like what we have on our other off-field podcast, where we just want to ask Nuffy questions. Mm-hmm. But the first one...
And you might think we've already done that,
The first one, before we get into the celebs and stuff like that, tips for someone who wants to take a nice portrait photo but all they've got is an iPhone.
Focus on the person first. And if you're not sure, you're not close enough.
Have you ever asked for an autograph of one of your subjects?
Not for me, never. I've asked an autograph of Ryan Lochte for a niece who is a swimming fan.
Okay. I'm going to say outside of Trump, just in case you're going to have him as this answer, but the biggest ego you've ever photographed?
Yeah, it's Donald Trump.
outside of Donald Trump.
Yeah. No, most people are pretty humble. It's crazy. It is Donald Trump and there's no one else. Sorry. It's really, okay, I know it's outside of that.
Podcasts you listen to?
WTF, Mark Maron, because his way of just finding those moments with real people. Obviously the news podcasts I love, and I do, you know, Jalen and Jacoby, even though I don't really know what they're talking about half the time, the American sport, I just love the banter.
The one person that you want to photograph?
I would like to photograph?
Yep.
I'd like to photograph the Queen, but I better hurry up because it's just the Australian back in the palace, you know, that's really what it's about.
Can you facilitate that? Like if you,
no,
with your connections, you can't go and knock on the gates of Buckingham Palace.
Did you have a number? I can't. Bring it on. No, I don't. I actually worked as a photo assistant, photographing the Royal Collection years ago. It was fantastic.
Music that you play on set, if any, and your own personal music tastes, what do you listen to?
I used to bring a boom box and DVD and CDs and get the subject to pick what they wanted to play. It was an interesting process of having them listen to what they wanted. I just listen to a lot of great Australian music. Paul Kelly on the road is always a great thing to listen to. It keeps you sane, it keeps you centered, and keeps you pretty humble.
There's nothing more Australian sounding than Paul Kelly.
Nothing.
I don't think.
Nothing, you know. Paul Kelly on the road, when you jump in that car and you're just cruising down, you know, just some foggy highway and you're just thinking about things, it really is amazing music.
We can't complete this interview without you telling us about your Cone Dogs project.
Yes. Yes. I have this side project. I travel so much I can't have a dog. I love dogs. I would have three of them at home if I could, but I wouldn't be able to look after them. So with a friend, I started trying to figure out, is there a dog project I can shoot to give myself time with dogs? And then, you know, we'd walk around the streets of New York and see these dogs with cones and I'd laugh my ass off. And then I looked around and no one had really covered it. So now, like, what I do is on weekends, I photograph people's dogs, and I've had the greatest days. And the funniest part, besides hanging out with the dogs, looking at me like, "Really, buddy? Do you really need to be here?" Is some people do the homework, and they go, "I've seen what else you do. Why are you in my house photographing my dog?" Or they say, "Are you a pet photographer?" I go, "Yes."
I thought you were going to say you've photographed some of the presidential dogs.
I wanted to photograph the Obama's dogs, but then they would have had to get hurt or something. The ethics of cone dog photography is very serious. Oh. They can't just put a cone on a dog. It has to really be in recovery.
So it's not a prop. You can't.
God, no.
It's got to be a genuine detext.
Seriously, it has to be in recovery. Authentic. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
And so that's on Instagram for people who want to
check it out. Yeah, go to Cone Dogs, and I'll be wrapping up this trip to Australia. I'm going to go through Tokyo, so we're going to search for Cone Dogs of Tokyo.
You've been mistaken for James Heard. Has anyone given you the Keith Urban before?
Yeah, I've had Americans in the South say that too. Yeah, I think maybe because I've never met an Australian.
Last question for Andrew.
Oh, no, no, no. We're wrapping up. The man's a busy man.
Look, Ben, thank you so much for giving us your time and coming on Rooster Radio. And I feel that, you know, I'd love to do this over a few beers in New York one day when we come back to the States and peel away even more of the incorrect stories that we shouldn't know about.
And quickly, the backstory for our listeners is Ben Fitzsimmons, who we call the patron of Rooster Radio, one of our first guests. He mentioned to us over lunch at the start of the week, oh, there's this guy that you should really interview. Like, he's awesome. You might have to do it over Skype because he's in New York and that sort of stuff. And then he rings me yesterday and said, he's in Adelaide. Can you meet him tomorrow?
It was great. It was perfect timing.
Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Great to be here. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to our chat with Ben Baker. Check out his work at benbakerphoto.com. At Rooster Radio, we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. Remember to subscribe, and if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on iTunes. Visit roosterradio.biz to sign up to our mailing list and listen to previous episodes.